Welcome to the Time Management Podcast with me, your host, Abigail Barnes. I'm a productivity coach, global speaker, time management author, and award-winning entrepreneur on a mission to share the 888 formula with the world and to remind you that it's your time. Leave it to me to bring you new time management tips, tricks, tools, and strategies, to introduce you to guests, research, and case studies from around the world, and to give you a simple five-step process you can follow to up-level your productivity, achieve your goals, and create a life that exceeds your wildest dreams. I'm so excited that you're here, so let's get started. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited you're here today, and I am joined by special guest Pasha Marlowe. Pasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, happy to be here, Abigail.
Let's just dive straight in. Who is Pasha Marlowe in a nutshell?
I am a seeker. I am a learner. I am curious. I am a mama bear to three kids. And in terms of work, I am an expert in neurodiversity and have a background in marriage and family therapy and love human patterns, and really just from a wholehearted place want to empower people to have agency and make decisions for themselves about their identity and offer their support and access needs unapologetically.
I'm really, really excited to dive into this conversation today. But before we get to that and to you explaining what it all means, let's talk about your relationship with time back in the day. What was it like?
Back in the day, when I was a child, my time was based on what my parents thought I should be doing at any particular time, or what I should be doing at school, or when I should graduate, and when I should get married, and when I should go to college, and when I should have children. So I was very much on society's idea from a neuronormative, heteronormative standpoint, what I should be doing. As I've aged, and basically when I hit menopause, I was like, hey, wait a minute. What about my time, my thoughts, my beliefs? So now I'm on a bit more of a cyclical time where I go by my energy and I go by my mood and desire more than society time or clock time.
What was your pivotal moment when it came to helping you to see things, helping you to see time differently?
My youngest son became very ill when he was 11, and he had to miss 3 years of school. I stopped my current career, or my career at the time, to take care of him. And time stopped, like slowed down really fast. It slowed down really fast. Immediately it did. And this is right before the pandemic, where for a lot of people, time again slowed. And so we were in a space where I couldn't follow time. It didn't even matter what day of the week it was or what time of the day was. It was all about keeping him safe and alive. And that was a catalyst moment for me, because I had to let go of my expectations of time for my work, chores, household stuff, exercise, like all the things, even eating or when I could take a shower. It didn't matter.
Let's dive into time and neurodivergence conversation. Before we go any further, what is neurodivergence?
I'm so glad you asked. Neurodivergent is an identity. It's not a diagnosis. It is for people who identify and diverge from society's idea of what is the normal or right or ideal way to think, learn, move, act, love. So there's neurotypical, which is the way society is structured. You know, in a neurotypical, this is the best way, the right way, the normal way, the ideal way to think, learn, act, love. Then there's people like me, and I think a lot of creative nonlinear thinkers who diverge, and whether it's because of ADHD or autism or trauma or traumatic brain injury or epilepsy or Down syndrome, or name 100 different divergencies, neurodivergencies, we don't innately or in an acquired sense any longer meet those stereotypical societal views of what is normal or ideal. And so we choose to identify as neurodivergent and different rather than disordered, because a lot of structures and institutions for instance, in the mental health field, would name us disordered, would label us disordered because we think differently. And so one of my platforms is to let go of disorder rather than saying ADHD, which has disorder in it, autism spectrum disorder, PTSD disorder at the end, bipolar disorder. Let's just drop the disorder from the conversation. It's a difference. It's divergent. It doesn't mean bad. It doesn't mean broken. It doesn't mean a problem. But we've been made to feel that way. And so people who identify as neurodivergent are stepping away from that idea of being disordered.
What are some of the common misconceptions that you see coming up about neurodiversity?
One of the main ones is that people believe that neurodiversity is talking about ADHD, autism, dyslexia, the end. Like learning differences, cognitive differences, learning disabilities, intellectual disabilities. And it's really so much broader. We as a human species are neurodiverse. Like everyone has a different brain and nervous system, and neuro means nervous system, not just brain. So everyone has a different brain and body. I think we can agree on that. And that's neurodiversity. I think when people hear it for the first time, they think we're talking about specific neurotypes. So everyone is neurodiverse. Neurodiversity is for everyone. And some people identify as neurodivergent.
What I hear you say, that everybody's neurodiverse. We all operate in different ways, but some people are neurodivergent. Is anybody neurotypical?
I ask myself this often. Sometimes I think that people who are neurotypical are still kind of following society's ideas of what, quote unquote, is normal or should be done. And they're maybe not yet exploring different options. So there's that. But I also think, because I don't want to dismiss that some people do not have the privilege of hiding their neurodivergence, right? So I can present in a neurotypical way. I can mask up and keep all the privilege of a neurotypical person. But when I unmask, I know that if I were to truly embody my neurodivergence, it would show, and it does quite a lot. But for some people, let's say somebody who's autistic and nonverbal, somebody who has Down syndrome, somebody who is ADHD and struggles to live by themselves. Like, and then it's more apparent. And for some, neurodivergence is a disability, and for some, it's not. For some people, it is impossible to mask up or to be non-apparent in it. And so I think that, and again, some neurodivergence is acquired, such as trauma or traumatic brain injury, and some is innate, such as ADHD and autism. I suppose there are neurotypical people out there, because it's a bit of a social construct in and of itself, what is neurotypical and what is neurodivergent. But the statistics will show that only 20 to 30% of people are neurodivergent. And that's a very limited view of what neurodivergent is. That's speaking about specifically ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dysgraphia. It's really a narrow view. If we were to widen that and say, okay, how many people have mental health struggles, labeled disorder, including anxiety, trauma, bipolar? Okay, now how many people are ADHD, autistic, dyslexic, all the things? Okay, now how many people have epilepsy, Down syndrome, right? Now it's really a lot, a big percentage. I'm going to say 70 to 80%, but that's my best guess because there's not research on it. Does that make sense?
Very much does make sense. And it sounds like it's a large sliding scale, and it depends on your consciousness to yourself and your ability to express your thoughts, feelings, opinions, views on where you are in life in general.
Yeah. And it also changes as our life changes. I think we see now more people coming out as neurodivergent. Half of Gen Z identifies as neurodivergent and disabled, by the way. A third of millennials did. I'm like, that's interesting. Why is it increasing? It's not because of TikTok or more videos. Partly it's more awareness and more research, thank goodness, including girls and women. But I also think society's becoming more disabling. It's becoming harder in the age of the digital world, AI, more loneliness, more mental health struggles, more trauma. It's becoming harder to live in a neurotypical world as somebody who has maybe sensitivities and, you know, we feel a lot, we see a lot, we intuit a lot. There's a lot of pain in the world. And so I think a lot of the acquired neurodivergencies are going to come out through mental health struggles.
What advice would you give to somebody who is at the start of this journey trying to work out where they fit in? Perhaps that might be their first step. I don't seem to be like everybody else I'm around. I don't think in the same way. What would be your advice to somebody in that place?
Yeah. Well, my first advice is to, even if the label such as ADHD has disorder in it, you do not have to internalize that stigma and pathologizing. You do not have to label yourself or identify with disorder. You can choose the identity neurodivergent and feel some empowerment in that, because a neurodivergent is not a, it has no value to it. It's not bad nor good. But you can also connect with other people who have similar neurotypes or similar values, and that will make you feel less alone in it. Because what I hear more often than anything is that we feel like aliens. We feel like we've been dropped into this planet. We didn't get the rule book. We're not exactly sure how to act or feel or dress or move. So we're going to kind of look around and see how everyone else is doing it. And we're going to feel like everyone else figured it out better than we did. That's a very common experience for a neurodivergent person. And so know that you're not alone in that. And know that if you connect with other people, like let's say you connect with other people who are ADHD or other people who have traumatic brain injury, for example, you're going to feel a sense of belonging and community that perhaps you wouldn't otherwise. So, and of course, there's some therapists who are aware and educated in this, in the field of neurodivergence, and coaches. I definitely highly recommend reaching out to them for support on how to not cure, not fix, but manage some of the traits and challenges that do come up. For example, with ADHD and autism, often I'll work with individuals and couples on ways to manage it and create systems to make their life easier by talking about their access and support needs. So there's ways to bring more ease and pleasure into our life, but the goal is not to become neurotypical, and the goal is not to cure or fix.
This conversation is fascinating, and we could take it off in so many different ways. It's making me think back to my university days when we did a team building exercise and we learned about norming, storming, and performing, and this is how teams come together. And in essence, it harks back to what you were saying just now about how you're trying to work out where you fit in. And that's one of the stages of the teamwork. And sometimes somebody is emerging as the leader and another person is emerging as the number two, the follower. This is just specifically in a team building exercise. And then others are looking to see how others in the team are responding and where they're fitting in. And everybody is going through this norming stage. Who do I need to be in this group, in with this community, with this tribe, with this way of working, this type of job? Give us an example of the kinds of things that you're seeing in your practice when clients are coming to you, and what patterns you're starting to notice. How are you moving people through their process?
For people in partnership, for example, when we talk about masking, if I'm masking in my home with the people who I live with, I'm going to feel unseen, I'm unsupported, maybe even unloved. I'm going to feel a sense of loneliness. Even if I hear that I'm loved, I'm not going to fully feel like they understand me and know me. So there's this extra level of conversation and awareness and empathy that comes into play between partners, usually, where we say, you know, and sometimes we get diagnosed later in life or discover our neurodivergence later in life, and we then become more neurodivergent. So when I received the diagnosis of autism, for example, I did become more autistic. I felt more autistic and I acted more autistic because I finally had an understanding and words and research and knowledge behind my experience. So I was able to finally unmask about being very sensitive about things like sound or light or smells or textures. I was always sensitive, but I just thought I was being too sensitive. Then I got the diagnosis and I'm like, oh, okay, this is why. Now I can explain to my partner, the sound is disabling. This light is disabling for me, for example. And there's an extra level of compassion and empathy and management around it. So that's what I see in families. And that translates to parents as well as partners. And then at workplaces, I talk to leaders and CEOs often, and they, for example, feel like they need to mask their vulnerabilities, mask their own traumas, mask grieving because they don't want to be a burden, because they don't want to shift the energy in the team, because they want people to respect them and trust them. They feel like, oh, if they knew about this learning disability I have, they would no longer trust me or respect me. If they only knew how much work I did behind the scenes, if they only knew how hard this was. And so there's this internalized ableism and shame that sometimes comes about that I see often in workplaces. So I talk to leaders about leading with vulnerability, because as soon as they share their needs and struggles, somebody else, no doubt in the room, feels psychologically safer and liberated to also share theirs. And now all of a sudden, more needs are accommodated and the workplace is more easeful and caring for all. When I talk to organizations about creating cultures of neuroinclusion, that extends to some people need bright open spaces and collaborative work. Some people need noise-canceling headphones and a cubicle. You know, some people need transcripts and some people need visuals and some people need audio. Everyone needs different things for their learning styles. And I think we need to talk to the people at our workplaces more and say, what do I not understand about how you think or learn? What would allow you to thrive in this workplace more? And the fear is, oh, great. Well, everyone's going to ask for remote work. Everyone's going to ask for noise canceling headphones. Everyone's going to ask for an emotional support animal. But that's not true. Typically, the average accommodation I think I've heard is like $500 or less. And often what happens is if you accommodate one person's need or disability, it helps everybody. And the classic example is a curb cut. You put a curb cut in the sidewalk so a wheelchair user can allow themselves to safely roll down. But anyone with a suitcase or a baby stroller or a walker has enjoyed the benefits of a curb cut before. So that's like a classic example of serving one and solving for many in inclusive design.
Picking up from what you just said, if we're becoming more aware of our neurodivergence, and 70 to 80% of people have them. If you were advising an organization on how to best accommodate the neurodivergence of their workforce, what would you say is the best place for them to start?
I recommend starting with asking people what they need, believing them when they say who they are and what they need, affirming what they ask for, and accommodate. I believe people with neurodivergence still have the ability and capacity to make these changes for themselves and for each other, first of all. But I think it needs to come from the top. I think it needs to be a non-performative effort by, for example, organizations to lead in a way where accommodations are supported, where sharing access and support needs is supported, and that the leaders also model their needs, right? If they say, you know, everyone should have clear boundaries and not work beyond 40 hours a week, and then they go and they answer emails in the middle of the night, they're modeling to the rest of their team that boundaries don't matter. And so I think we need to, from the top, make these more systemic changes that will affect everybody and empower everybody to claim what they need.
If everybody has a different preference, everybody has a different accommodation that they need, How does an organization close the window, open the window, turn down the noise, turn up the noise, accommodate the support animals, accommodate the desire not to have an animal anywhere near them? What do you do?
Yes. Valid question. So this is why a lot of neurodivergent people are suggesting remote work options, flexible options, hybrid options, for one. Also different working spaces. So within an office, for example, there might be one seating area with comfy chairs that face each other in front of a window. And then there might be a nook in a small corner for somebody who at that moment needs to reduce their sensory overload and go there. Most often than not, it is not that everyone in the place needs, you know, weighted blankets and headphones and animals. That's not the norm. What most people find is that if one person says, you know, noise canceling headphones are really handy, somebody else in the room might be like, I've never tried them. Let me see. Oh my goodness, this helps me. I did not know how much extra noise was distracting me. So often it's not like we're accommodating one person and everyone else in the place needs something different and there's 20 different variations. Often solving a problem for one person, it does serve many. And a lot of the accommodations that people ask for, such as closed captions, transcripts, details, more clarification, do help everybody.
I love this. Such a great explanation. Thank you. And I remember when I was in school, I used to have to get the teacher to explain things in two different ways. So they would explain it once to the class in the way that most people got it. Then I would ask them if you could explain it in a different way. And it didn't go down that well. I can totally understand the hesitancy to ask for things. But when you do ask, what I'm hearing you say is it gives other people the opportunity to experiment as well. And I think that in life, this is it. We are here to experiment. And also, what works one week might not work the next week. Maybe in some ways, the ability to understand that we are all human beings doing our different being, and we don't all have to do it the same way. In essence, if we were cooking in the kitchen, every ingredient that we're adding is making the meal become the meal it is. So we all need all the different ingredients. And
I love that metaphor of the recipe, adding in different spices and different ingredients makes it more rich. And I think about it musically, you can't make harmony with one note. You need more than one note to create a harmony. And so it does add richness and color. And from a business standpoint, the business case for it is, you know, more collaboration, better problem solving, nonlinear thinking leads to innovation, critical thinking solves the problems, the systemic problems. So we need both. And AI is quite linear in its progression of like, this leads to this, or this yes leads to this no. It's linear and very useful for many things and not useful for other things. So we need both. We need the linear thinkers and the nonlinear thinkers. And sometimes nonlinear is called lateral thinking, critical thinking, or divergent or neurodivergent thinking. So we need both.
Music is such a great example. You have the bass, you have the next layer, you have the harmony, you have the different instruments. And if you ask somebody what they're listening to when they listen to music, you ask 10 different people. 10 different people are listening to 10 different parts of the music. And sometimes when you say, oh, can you hear that? They then hear it. And I guess this is feeding into what you said about if one person has the noise cancelling headphones and another person tries it and it works, then you are helping other people to broaden their way of working.
Absolutely. So many people don't even know. Well, people can go through their entire life ADHD and never know that their brain is structured in that way because they've either been working very hard to follow the system or the rules or the structures, or they've been masking, or they haven't been admitting the challenges. And then they hear something like a list of 100 different traits of ADHD and they're like, I have all those traits. One of the reasons why you hear so many people in midlife coming out as neurodivergent, discovering their neurodivergence, let's say ADHD, is because their children in school get diagnosed. They go to a 504 meeting, an IEP meeting, whatever you call it, where you live. And then they look at the list of things that why the teacher is concerned or suggesting this diagnosis. And they're like, well, that's just the way our family is. Like, that's just the way people are, because they do share the same neurotype. So many of the neurotypes are genetic.
And that is what is so, so interesting, is that that sentence is generally used. Well, that's just the way we are. And that's just the way we have to be. And that's just the way it's always. People that do this are like this, and people that do that are like that. So maybe what I'm hearing you say is that as we embrace this and we consider different things, we start to recognize, oh, okay, and not everybody has to be. And that's fantastic, because what you bring by being like this helps us to see something in a truly different way. And for organizations, that's what gives you that winning edge. Because if everybody's the same and you get groupthink, then how are you going to be evolving?
Absolutely. And I think related to time, if organizations have this appreciation for the diversity of thought and mind, somebody might say, suggest starting a project, and one neurotype just jumps right in before you've gone anywhere. They have the logo already designed. The brochure is done. They've already implemented it and posted on social media. Another person wants to be very methodical about it, do some research, take more time to make a decision. Often there's quick thinkers, and neither good nor bad. There's people who jump very quickly from one idea to another, like a box jumper versus a box stepper. So I think, again, we need both.
Where does neurodivergence fit in with the personality testing? Because we've had somebody on the show before. We were talking about something called human design, and human design is more on the esoteric, the spiritual side of the spectrum. But then on the other side, you've got the discs, you've got the MBTIs, you've got the strengths finders, you've got the insights. How do all of these work together?
I have found that the more traditional, like the discs, INTJ, I don't even remember what that one's called, personality tests are not highly accurate or indicative of what's really going on, because often a neurodivergent person, and this is very, that would be too general to say, I would say, let's say somebody autistic might take the questions very literally. If it says, do you sometimes, always, never, they might say very literally, well, always, that's not possible. And they'll diverge to a answer that isn't as, you know, nuanced as maybe the test was designed, because that one time in that one second, they didn't do that. So all of a sudden it's not always right. And so I think a lot of the personality tests don't work for all types of minds who learn differently or perceive information differently. And so often I'll talk to a manager and they'll call me for a consultation. They'll say, I hired this person. They assessed this way on the DISC assessment, and they're not doing anything I expected. They're not following through. I don't understand their pace, their rhythm. And then I'll talk to the person. I'll say, how come you answered the question this way? They're like, oh, well, that day, that day I was feeling what my dog died, and this is why I was feeling this way, and this is how I answered these questions that day. That's, I would answer completely differently today. And so I think the personality tests have a lot to be desired.
And it's such an interesting one, because it almost seems to me like we have a human obsession to give ourselves a title and put ourselves into boxes. I am this, I am that, this is how I do it. In my experience personally, it's that the journey of life is an evolution, and sometimes I'll have done it one way and sometimes I'll want to do it another way. And my answer to a lot of those tests over the years was, it depends.
Yes, yes.
I don't answer questions in a binary way, yes or no, because sometimes, well, most of the time, it depends how I feel. It depends what month it is. Depends what day of the week it is. It depends what I had for breakfast.
Absolutely. And I notice now a pattern of people who go through menopause, for example, big hormonal shift, how it changes our perceptions of introversion, extroversion, oversensitivity, hypersensitivity, hyposensitivity. There's so many changes that happen in our life cycle that would change completely those tests. I feel like I'm a different person than I was 5 years ago, and certainly a different person than I was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
I sometimes feel like that in a day. I live five lifetimes in one day.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Let's talk about time as a social construct. Tell me more about your perspective of time and the way that we are raised to view it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's world time, you know, the whole world is determined, you know, daylight, nighttime, nighttime, daytime. Then there's clock time. We all have these different clocks. Sometimes we jump ahead. Sometimes I hate that, by the way, the time zone change is very confusing. But there's also this internal time. You know, I can't so much tell for myself if I've been sitting here for 5 minutes or an hour. It's hard for me to perceive that, especially if I'm enjoying myself and lit up and engaged and interested. Time really does fly by, and it goes quite fast. And then other times, like when my kiddo was sick, it just stopped and went at a snail's pace. So I think that there's, and in terms of capitalism, there's the, this is the time to work and produce from 9 to 5. And I think we're moving away from that because some people are more productive at 2 in the morning, and maybe remote work or project-based work would be more effective. So I think that's the social construct dynamic. And going back to linear and nonlinear thinking, somebody who's nonlinear or lateral or divergent in their thinking gets a spark of an idea and can for 8 hours do brilliant research and work around it, and then be in bed for 2 days after to recover from the emotional and physical toll that that innovation took. And that should be honored. It's not for everybody. That's not the kind of job, if you're working retail, that doesn't work for you, because then you need to be there at a certain time when the store opens up. But in my work, I can do that. I can schedule a keynote in the beginning of the month and know for the next 2 weeks, I should not schedule a keynote, right? And so that's that rhythmic or cyclical time instead of clock time.
It sounds to me like we're talking about the work of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi when he talks about how we get into that flow state and then time just seems to cease to exist. And then overlaid, I'm not sure if you've read the book Big Leap by Gay Hendricks. He talks about how we have Einstein time and we have Newtonian time, and that Einstein time is the ability to not pay attention to time and start to bend time and achieve things that other people might think are impossible. We're moving into a world where we can just consider and investigate what has always been the norm.
Yes, I agree. And by the way, the younger generations, as if they came out of the womb ready to disrupt the status quo, are challenging those norms. They're like, why do we do it this way? 9 to 5, that makes no sense. Like they're challenging everything. And I know that worries a lot of people. However, I believe because the world is changing as quickly as it is and evolving in the way it is, especially with things like AI coming up, I believe we need the divergent nonlinear thinkers to voice that, to voice, why are we doing it this way? Because if AI is based on everything that has happened before, and you talk about something like systemic racism, it's just going to perpetuate the problem. So you need people to be still critical in their thinking when they see the information that is offered as fact. It's not.
The need to understand how we got to where we've got to in order to be able to move forward. As you're saying, the world is becoming inclusive of AI. AI is almost like another skill set that's being added to the mix. AI is its own divergence in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's my opinion that the humans need to understand themselves. This is where we're at, the juncture that we're at, world and in society at the moment, is know yourself, know your way of working, know your skill set, know your preferences, and find organizations, people, and places where you can express your needs and they can be accommodated. And if they're not, move on.
Yeah. And that's why the younger generations are so entrepreneurial, because they're not going to sit around and wait for a culture to change to include them and accommodate them. They're going to find another job or another company, or they're going to create their own, you know? And with the world being as remote as it is, they can make a living doing that. They don't need to work for a corporation necessarily. But if they feel quite aligned, and what I do is I go to organizations and teach them how to create cultures of neuroinclusion so that they can still attract and retain and support and elevate neurodivergent talent, even Gen Zers. And disabled talent, as well as LGBTQIA talent. I think that all three work together in the sense of diverging from norms. And I think ultimately that is going to need to be embraced and supported.
I want to bring this back to my earlier analogy with the cooking. It almost feels and sounds like to me we are going back to the kitchen with the old recipe book, and we are going through that old recipe book full of comfort foods, if you like, and ways of cooking with ingredients that have always been used, and every single word on the pages is being questioned.
I love
that. That is shaking the foundations of some people who like it the way it is, and some people who are here to rewrite the recipe book, the rule book for life.
Absolutely. That's so true. If I were to look at a recipe book, like The Joy of Cooking, for example, and see where there's no gluten-free option, there's no dairy-free option, this isn't heart healthy. You know, we learn more. And as we learn more, we implement more. Know better, do better. So I'm not going to follow that recipe. I'm going to adjust it to my own needs and to what I've learned about nutrition and health and wellness since it was published.
And even insofar as, and I can make a recipe that doesn't need to be baked. Everything is being rearranged.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. I love that analogy.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but while you're going through the destruction and the rebuild to come to the next new step on the journey, can you live, and how do you live in a world that is being rebuilt?
Yes. And yeah, and I don't want to get too controversial here, but the people who have the most power and privilege are the ones who are going to be the most challenged by any of these new structures or systems. They're going to be challenged by people who, you know, question authority, challenge norms. They're going to be challenged by divergent thinkers. And so it's going to be interesting to see as we go and as the younger generations come into leadership positions, how things will shift.
It's fascinating, Pasha. I feel like the world has never needed somebody like you more to guide us through the journey. As we're wrapping up this conversation today, I have a few more questions for you. How are you structuring your work and your life, your family, your relationships in and around what it is that you want from the time that you have?
Well, the older I get, it certainly does feel like time is limited. I see time again from a more energetic and cyclical way in terms of how I spend my time. I check in with myself each day and I say, not just what is my ability, because I could plow through it, but what is my capacity today? What is my mood? What is my intuition telling me? That's where I post insights from and content from, is from that place of, what do I feel like I need to say today? What really needs to be said today? So that's that time. Then there's also me feeling like I should have been farther along by now. I get myself caught up in that. By now, okay, I'm 54 this year. By now, I should have found a life partner. By now, I should be financially independent. By now, I should have been able to travel to more countries. I do get still very caught up in that, feeling like I've lost too much time or wasted too much time or don't have enough time. And that gets me in a very scared, scarcity place. And so I'm trying to be very cautious about that and mindful about coming back to every moment. I make the best decisions I can with where I am and what I know now. And I need to surrender a bit to that and forgive myself for any times that I didn't make a decision that could have landed me in a different place. So it's a process of patience and forgiveness and compassion that I'm like finally learning to offer myself to do things on my time and not worry so much about other people's opinions and values.
I love that. You've made peace with who you are, how you do it. And I'm also hearing that you're doing an energy check-in with yourself every day. What return have I got on the time I've invested? How do I feel as a result of the energy I've expended?
Yeah. In the neurodivergent and disability world, we often talk about spoons. How many spoons do I have today? How many spoons do I have left? I'm not exactly sure how it started with spoons, but I will say that if, let's say, you have 5 spoons, your capacity is 5 spoons of the day, and you've already used up 4 of them just to get your kid out the door and make breakfast and feed the dog and all the things, and some call came in you weren't expecting, and now there's a doctor's visit you weren't expecting, and you're done. That might be a day where 0 laundry gets done, 0 dishes, 0 shower, You might have to cancel appointments. You might literally in your capacity be done. If you push through it, that leads to exhaustion, burnout, masking, physical and mental health struggles. So I've been far more cautious and patient and aware of that dynamic because I know where it led me in the past.
5 spoons. That's fantastic. I'd probably need 10, or maybe I'd chop a spoon in half. When it comes to time, tell us something that you do on a daily basis with your time that you don't think other people do, like a secret.
I write comedy in my head. If I'm trying to sleep and I'm too stressed to sleep, if I'm feeling distracted and I can't stop the spinning in my head and need to get focused, I write comedy based on my own life experiences that I may never share or perform anywhere. But seeing things through the lens of humor and seeing life and humanity as a bit of a stand-up comedy act in and of itself lightens the load for me. And it helps me use my brain actively, but with a little bit more joy and pleasure, which is very hard for me to do on a day-to-day otherwise, because I tend to just be super intense because I think a lot, which is great, but it exhausts me. So I write comedy to take back my time and power and pleasure.
So you script the comedy in your head. Do you ever physically write it out? Is this going to be a next career?
I've done a little bit of stand-up, and interestingly, I'm hired every once in a while. I'm doing this in a couple of weeks to do a whole comedy show about being neurodivergent and queer. In a Catholic school who hired me, which is really fascinating. So that's going to be fun. So yes, sometimes I actually write it out, script it out, and sometimes I actually perform it. But often it's just literally thinking like, this is so bad, it's funny. Or what's funny about this? Or can I bring any humor into this miserable situation? It just lightens my mood quite a bit. And I feel like it's a reclamation of my joy.
Love it. As we wrap this conversation up today, is there anything else you would like to share with us?
I want people to feel agency and autonomy to make decisions for themselves as to how they perceive time and how they use time and what their support needs are. And I want people who are in relationship with other people, be it parents, partners, coworkers, to offer people that agency and space to make those decisions. And when people share them, to believe them and honor them and not debate them on their own identity and existence.
What have you got coming up in 2024?
More speaking engagements to talk about neurodiversity, creating cultures of inclusion, mental health. And I still offer and very much enjoy coaching, especially with couples where one or both identify as neurodivergent. It really lights me up to see people connect on a deeper level and find more pleasure and intimacy and connection, you know, with their favorite people. So I really enjoy doing the individual and couples work there, and I'll continue to do that. More comedy, travel more with my work, get speaking engagements in places that I actually want to see that I've never seen before. That would be fun.
So exciting. Where is the best place to find you on the internet?
LinkedIn is the place where I really feel like people can understand my work and reach out to me very easily. I have a free 30-minute call in my LinkedIn profile so that people can talk to me about collaboration or coaching or hiring me to speak. And I post on there daily about issues like we're talking about. So I explore these areas. LinkedIn at Pasha Marlowe. But I also have a website, PashaMarlowe.com. And on there is all the information about my coaching, speaking, there's a speaker reel, all that, and all the other social media, because I am on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook as well.
Fantastic. And as always, nobody needs to panic. All the links are in the show notes. So yay. Pasha Marlowe, thank you so much. I feel like I could speak to you about this for hours. It's been such a fantastic conversation. I look forward to a part two, and anybody's thoughts, comments, questions, anything you would like to know further, let us know in the comments. We so much look forward to hearing from you. Pasha Marlowe, it has been amazing to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Abigail. Thanks everybody for listening.
Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay well, and remember, it's your time.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. If you loved what you heard, be sure to let me know by leaving a review so I can keep the good stuff coming.
Come and say hi on Instagram at Success by Design Training, or visit my website, successbydesigntraining.com, or connect with me on LinkedIn. Just search Abigail Barnes. Until next time, don't forget, you are amazing and it's your time.